Hey, it's Christine from Storyworthy. Today on the show, writer-producer Sasha Rothschild talks about getting run over by a train.
And I noticed that one of the doors of the train was sort of flapping open and closed as the train rumbled on. And I thought, how hard could it really be to run and try and jump into that door as it opens and closes and opens and closes? And I went for it. And I heard one man who was on the train track scream, "Don't jump!" But it was too late. I was already in the air with my huge platform heels, and I dove into the door.
Today on the show, writer-producer Sasha Rothschild shares the most terrifying story I have ever heard on this show. She was dragged under a train. Stay close.
Hi, it's Sasha Rothschild, and you're listening to Storyworthy. Welcome to Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm coming to you from Los Angeles, California. Whether you're a longtime fan of the show or a new listener, welcome to Storyworthy.
Now, I hope you guys enjoyed the show last week. It was Story Smash, the storytelling game show, live. Our judges were Larry King, Wendy McClendon Covey, and Danny Zucker. And I have to tell you, this episode was off the hook. At one point, Danny kisses Larry. I'm not kidding. So go back and listen to that.
But not today, because I'm here with writer Sasha Rothschild, and I've been wanting you on the show for a while now. You know this.
I know this.
So I'm very happy you're here. And then you come out with the title of the show, of the episode, and your story, "I Was Dragged Under a Train." And it's so visual.
It will be more visual when I describe what exactly happened to me.
I can't wait to hear. I just can't wait. And now I'm glad you're okay. I mean, you look like you're in one piece.
I am very lucky, and I do. I look like a normal working human being.
Right. When I was a kid, we would put pennies on the railroad tracks behind my grandmother's house, and then the train would come by, and then we'd pick up our pennies. You don't look anything like a smashed penny.
Thankfully. Yeah.
So listen,
it's a bit of a miracle.
You must be so excited because GLOW is now in its second season.
Second season is out.
Yes.
I'm so excited to share it with the world.
You know, we had Rebecca Johnson on the show a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
She is so talented. She has such a good presence. And she told this amazing story about fainting for really no reason. And the thing is, I could totally relate. And we both fainted at the Piercing Pagoda when we were kids.
Oh, yes, at the mall?
At the mall,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense. Well, yeah. That's not for no reason, though. I feel like that's a, you know.
Right. But it's just that anxiety when you feel the wave is coming and it's going to take you over and you're going to go down.
And you're down.
And in my particular situation, you know, they did the first ear. The lady did the hole in the first ear, and then I passed out, woke up on a bench under the parrot cage in the mall, and my mom made the girl come over and do the other ear because we'd already spent the $9.99.
You have to have both ears done. You know, I too am a fainter when it comes to needles.
No kidding.
Every time.
You're really going to enjoy Rebecca's story because it all comes down to mind over matter. You know what I mean? In other words, like letting that wave come and knowing it's going to happen and you're going to be okay anyway.
Yeah. You will not die. You'll just very delicately fall to the floor.
Yeah.
I've tried to learn how to faint in a sort of a romantic manner.
Really?
Like very sort of a slow.
Yes.
Dramatic.
Lean up against a wall.
Yeah.
I'm going to sit now.
Right, a fainting couch.
Well, listen, it is the worst feeling in the world.
It really is.
But anyway, Rebecca was just on the show, and we were talking about GLOW, and you are a writer on the show. You are a producer on the show.
Yes.
Kind of depends, right, what your credit is on the show each and every episode?
Well, the way it works is for writers, you are there in the writer's room the whole season, and then specific episodes get divvied up. So as you work your way up as a writer, mm-hmm. your title changes, and eventually you become a producer, a supervising producer, a co-executive producer, and then an executive producer. So your role of producer is on the set. You actually are watching everything be shot. You're making decisions. You're working with the director. You're working with the cinematographer or the DP. And so you do have a producer role as well as also being a writer.
it really is very, very confusing to people who don't know this industry.
Yes.
I have been in LA now almost 21 years, and I'm just getting it. And it's only because, like, I'm doing my own show and learning the steps. And you've done that. You have such a past in casting and in all these different roles. And so it is interesting how there is literally a ladder, and your credits do change over time. But at the end of the day, you seem to have to know all of it.
It's helpful. It's helpful to have your first 10 years in LA having a bunch of random jobs sort of doing it all, because then when you do get to the place you hope to be, whatever that is, you can have a sense of how an entire production works.
I mean, and you are at the place you want to be, right?
I mean, there's more to do, but you've
got to be so pleased.
I am very happy.
Yeah.
And it did take a solid 10 years in LA of waitressing and having odd jobs. Like, I was the girl in the box at the Standard Hotel for a while when I was young.
You know, I interviewed Lilibet Snellings, and she was another. Do you know Lilibet?
Yes, yes.
Wow.
I know. Yes, that's very funny.
For those of you that don't know, the Standard Hotel in West Hollywood, behind the front desk, they would have this like aquarium, but there's no water in it. Instead, is a girl in there in usually a tank top and shorts.
So something small and white. That was it. You had to wear a little white, like a little white tank top, little
very
white
virgin,
undies.
Virgin-y.
Yes, very virginal. Yeah,
and then you would just live.
You would just hang out there as though you weren't to look at anyone or make eye contact. You were just sort of in there doing your nails or sleeping
or writing
in your journal. It was a way to get paid to do what you would do at home anyway.
Did you do any like crying or whimpering or anything like that? Because I thought that would be so funny.
No, well, it would be funny. You're instructed to look too cool for school and to be so over it all. And part of the audition process was to sort of like have a resting bitch face.
Oh my God.
And so
what does that look
crying
like?
Crying would, it's sort of like a eyes up. Like
bored.
I couldn't even make eye contact with you. I'm so bored.
Like
in here.
My 11-year-old.
Yes. Yes. It's very much like that. And I had actually just broken up with a really total asshole. Can I say asshole on your lovely podcast?
Sure.
And he really just wanted to tell me how fat I was every day of our relationship. And I broke up with him, and I started going to the gym, you know, two times a day, and got a little obsessed and lost a ton of weight and got really in shape. And that's when I thought, I'm going to punish him by being the box girl at the Standard. And
oh,
so it was like
gosh,
a real goal.
You know what? It worked. That is so cool.
Yeah,
right?
It was a good plan. And
that's
amazing. I was 24.
Did
it was
great.
Did
he ever come in and see you in that box?
I don't think he ever did, but I did run into him, not in the box, but elsewhere. And he was like, you're too thin. And I thought, you know what, this guy's such a jerk.
Oh, horrible. Horrible. But still, that's some pretty cool retribution. What if he had been in the lobby? Do you think you would have broken character?
I wouldn't have. It would have felt so good to not break character.
That's awesome, man. I think that's really funny. I didn't read that in your bio. I did read in your bio that you worked on The Bachelor.
I did work on The Bachelor. So when I moved to LA very specifically to be a TV writer, but it took many years to get there. I was writing
like
spec
about.
Scripts and trying to get an agent. And in the meantime, I fell into reality casting because I was pretty extroverted. And the way that happened was I was actually at a big courtyard party in Santa Monica and I needed a job. And I just yelled out into the whole courtyard, I need a job. Who's going to hire me? And these two guys came up to me and said, oh my God, you're perfect. We work on Big Brother. We need casting people to just sort of go out into the world and approach fun personalities to see if they would want to be on Big Brother. And that started me off on this reality casting journey for several years. And I did work on the season of The Bachelor.
Wait, when you would do that, would you go to college campuses? Where were you going?
I would go everywhere. So it depended on what show.
Shopping malls.
For The Bachelor, it was all that fancy mall in Newport Beach.
Oh,
because I was looking for the women that would be. So I would go to really high-end malls. I would go to Chicago. There is this mall. I can't remember now.
So they didn't have casting proper?
Like, so they had casting of, you know, asking people to send in videotapes and asking people to come to us. And then we held casting, huge casting sort of calls where we would be, you know, in Dallas at this convention center, come on down. That's so I would travel around and do that as well. But part of it was going out into the world and just sort of trying to spot the perfect person. And this was also years ago when The Bachelor was very popular, but not as popular as today. So we definitely needed people to just kind of spot. And I got good at spotting.
My mouth is just sort of hanging open because I didn't think that was real. Like, that job existed. Like, the people were just, like, looking for specific faces or whatever. Because you hear about that, like, in Danielle Steele novels or whatever. Yeah. You know, like, you know, then this woman tapped me on the shoulder and said, have you modeled before?
Yeah.
You know, or something. So you're telling me you actually would just go and plant yourself at the mall.
Yes.
And look for, okay, so who are you looking for?
So for The Bachelor at that time, I was looking, women. You know, I was looking for gorgeous, thin women, probably with fake boobs, who didn't have a wedding ring or an engagement ring on.
Perfect.
Who seemed very well-preserved and well-groomed and would just approach them and say, are you single? Would you be interested in meeting the perfect guy? Would you ever want to be on TV? And just go from there. And
right.
The fun thing was I got to meet totally random people. But if a woman wasn't interested, there'd always be, oh, my God, my best friend or my sister or this or that.
Yeah.
So the other thing I would do is for the big castings, like let's say, you know, open casting in Houston.
Yeah, 300 people come.
I would also go to bars and clubs in Houston and sort of invite attractive people to come to the casting.
That is so interesting.
It was an amazing way to spend my 20s because I got to travel. I really traveled all around the United States.
Yeah,
and my job
really
was to talk to strangers.
Yeah, that sounds like fun. What about the end of the show, you know, The Bachelors? I mean, how many now have stayed married? One or two?
I think maybe three. Not a lot. Amy Kaufman just wrote a great book called Bachelor Nation about all about the insider sort of stuff about that show.
The
and
Bachelor
she
World,
tell
yeah.
The Bachelor. She tells it all. So
it must
it's a good,
be hilarious.
Fun book.
Okay, we're
now
look
I'm plugging
that.
Other people's books.
No, but that does sound like fun. And yeah, but speaking of books, did you write the book How to Get Divorced by 30?
I did.
That's your book.
That's my book.
How interesting, because I saw that as well. That's I haven't read that, but boy, that looks so. You were divorced by 30.
Yes, yeah. I got married to a lovely guy who was a bartender actor, and I was a cocktail waitress writer, and we got married when I was 27, and all of my friends also got married at 27, and then at 29 and a half...
Listen, I got four sisters, and they all got married at
27 is sort of the year, as much as you don't want to buy into the rules of, oh, you need to get married, or marriage means anything, or it defines you, all that stuff that you think as a strong woman, independent, you don't... But 27 hit, and I was like, I need to get married. I need to cross that off my list. And so I got married, and at 29 and a half, it was so clear that we were not in love, and we were not happy. And we got divorced, and all of my friends also got divorced right before 30.
Wow.
And I had been...
Yeah, when you get married like that in sort of a frantic way, it's your first wedding.
Yes.
You don't have to take it that seriously, really.
Yeah.
Because it's never going
to
work.
And the song that we used for me to walk down the aisle was Joe Jackson's Is She Really Going Out With Him? So really, we neither of us took it all that seriously.
Sasha, that is so crazy.
And then I had been, you know, trying to write for TV and writing features and started writing articles in the meantime, which was very rewarding because I started writing and then seeing my work being published. And I had a meeting at LA Weekly, and I pitched them an article, How to Get Divorced by 30, because me and five friends all got divorced by 30, and they loved it, and I wrote it for them, a couple other things for them as well. And then that article was on the front page.
Wow.
that week of the LA Weekly, and within 1 week I had a movie deal and a book deal.
That's unbelievable. That is so exciting.
It was an amazing, that was the thing that pushed me into the next.
That is so interesting. You have such a large body of work, but like you're talking about it step by step, and you never really know where it's going to come from. And for me, it better be story smash. But the point is, but
you never know.
So exciting. Yeah. You don't know. And things have to start from somewhere. I mean, every idea starts from a blank page.
Yes.
So, you know, the best storytelling is somebody's true life, and that's hilarious.
No, it's hilarious. It's just a fun one. And it was really the antithesis. Wow. How to Get Divorced by 30 was the antithesis of Under the Tuscan Sun and Eat, Pray, Love and all these books about how you know, you run off to Europe and you find yourself.
Done, right.
And I'm like, no, you sit in your sad condo and you cry because you have to take the garbage out because your husband's gone, and you deal with it. And
Oh, man. Hey, Sasha, what do you think of my new glasses? Pretty cute, right?
Yes.
I know. I love them. I just got them. They're from Warby Parker. You know, like I do, that buying glasses can be so expensive.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time and it can just be overwhelming. I can never decide. Warby Parker has the answer by cutting out the middlemen and selling directly to customers online and in their stores. Warby Parker is able to provide high-quality, great-looking eyewear like this at a fraction of the usual price. Check it out. Their prescription glasses start at $95, and that includes the frames, the lenses, and the coatings. Because that's what I always hate when you go buy glasses. There's always like this charge and that charge, and then it gets super expensive.
Yeah.
But the people at Warby Parker think that glasses shouldn't cost more than your phone. And you might be thinking, well, how can you possibly buy glasses online? Well, with Warby Parker's completely free home try-on program, that's how, and that's what I did. Then you have 5 days to try them on and show them to your friends and family for an honest opinion on what looks best. And you know who I showed them to, Sasha? My mailman. And you know what? He likes them. How about that?
Yes.
You guys, it's 100% free and it's really easy. And when you find a pair of glasses you like, you go to warbyparker.com/storyworthy and you order your favorite pair. It's super, super simple. Plus, they'll even call your doctor if you don't have your prescription handy. So go to warbyparker.com. That's warbyparker.com/storyworthy to get started with a free home try-on. That's warbyparker.com/storyworthy to find your perfect pair of glasses today. warbyparker.com/storyworthy. All right, listen, let's get to your story. I was dragged under a train because I can't wait to hear about this train. But before we do get to Sasha's story, I wanted to remind you guys to head over to storyworthypodcast.com. Would you do that? And then also check out storysmashshow.com because that's the game show. And boy, oh boy, it's just a laugh. You know, Larry King is on the show this week.
That's so amazing.
I couldn't be more thrilled. And you guys, please join my mailing list over there. That's always nice. And of course, don't forget to tell a friend about the podcast because you guys are already listening. You know what I mean? So I don't want to preach to the choir. You have to share the information. And you tell those guys. It's free. You can listen on Spotify, NPR One, Stitcher. You know the drill. All right, you guys. She's here right now. Sasha Rothschild. She is a writer and a producer on the Netflix hit Glow, like we talked about. And also, you've been on a lot of other shows as a producer and a writer, like The Carrie Diaries. And like we said, you are the author of How to Get Divorced by 30. By the way, I was divorced at 26.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It didn't last long. Also, you were featured on This American Life.
Yes, that was a huge, incredible honor to be on that show. I was reading from my teenage diary when I was 13, running around Miami Beach doing cocaine off of stolen rearview mirrors.
Oh, my God.
And having the time of my life. And it became quite a controversial piece for This American Life. And
where were your parents?
They were, well, that's a good question. My father was hiding in his office in denial. And my mother was a really, she was what I call a submarine mom and not a helicopter mom. She was there, but not going to tell me what to do. She said to me, you know, you make your own decisions and you... you're an individual, and if you want to be a drug addict, that's your choice. And if you want to sleep with men with gold teeth, that's up to you. and she just hoped I would find my way out of it, which I did.
Wow, that is stunning. Do you have a good relationship with your mom?
I do. I love my mother. We are very close, and it all worked out.
Man, you got a lot of stories. You got a lot of stories. If you want to learn more about Sasha, head over and visit her on Twitter. Head over and follow her on Twitter @SashaRothschild. I can't believe you got that Twitter name. You're so lucky. I mean, it's your name.
It's my name. I got it. Well, you know, when my book came out, Twitter had just started to hit and nobody wanted, you know, nobody had taken my name yet. So
it's fabulous. I'm going to spell it for you guys. SASCHAROTHCHILD. All right, you guys, whoever you are, put your hands together for Sasha Rothschild.
Hello. Okay. So I went to college at Boston College because I didn't get into Yale, and Boston College was my safety school. And my best friend growing up went to Brown, which is only 45 minutes away by train. And our junior year, on December 3rd, I got a phone call from her. It was her 21st birthday, and her grandmother had died that day. And so she was totally drunk because she had just turned 21 and incredibly sad because her grandmother had died, and she was very close with her grandmother. Also that day, inexplicably, my mother, who is not the most maternal woman, like, for example, some of her advice to me was, if you must do heroin, always smoke it, never shoot up. That was sort of our level of my mother worrying about me. My mother called me that morning and just called to check in, to see how I was doing, to find out what I was doing that day. And she just had an odd sense of things, and she couldn't put her finger on it. So then I get the phone call from my friend who's a mess and wants me to quickly go to Providence, Rhode Island to spend time with her. This was in the middle of finals, and although I was quite rebellious in certain ways, I was always a really good student, very type A. I never missed class, and I had a 4.0 GPA. And the idea of going to Providence on a whim and possibly missing class the next day and not studying for finals was very upsetting to me, but she was my best friend. She was a mess. I needed to be there. So I book an Amtrak train. I go to Providence. And at the time, this was 1997, faux fur was very in. And my sister, who I'm close with, had made me this amazing faux fur cow print crossbody bag. And this will be important later. And I also was wearing huge platform heels because that was sort of my look. It was kind of 70s secondhand store. I tried to be as different from everyone else at Boston College as possible. So I get to Providence and I see my friend, and she's crying and she's drinking, and we go to have Mexican food, and I am not drinking at all. I'm absolutely sober because I have to study and because I have to get back, and I'm really a responsible person because I had actually done all my drinking and drugging in junior high. So by college, I was very straight-laced. So I'm with my friend, and it's time for me to get on back to Boston. The last train of the night was leaving 13 minutes after midnight at 12:13, and I am running down the train steps of the Amtrak station in Providence, Rhode Island, with my huge platform heels and my crossbody bag on my hip. And I see that my train is leaving the station, and somehow I must have been a few minutes late, and this is a disaster, and I can't miss class the next morning. And I noticed that one of the doors of the train was sort of flapping open and closed as the train rumbled on. And I thought, how hard could it really be to run and try and jump into that door as it opens and closes and opens and closes? And I went for it, and I took a running start, and I leapt, and I heard one man who was on the train track scream, "Don't jump!" But it was too late. I was already in the air with my huge platform heels, and I dove into the door, and my right hand and my right leg got inside the train, and I was clinging to the inside of the train with my right hand. My left leg didn't clear the gap that we are all supposed to mind. If you've ever been in London, there's that recording, Mind the Gap. If you've been on a subway station, there's that small space. So my left leg was in that gap. And as the train kept barreling forward, my left leg kept getting sucked deeper and deeper into the gap. And I could no longer hold on with my right arm. And finally, I let go and my whole body swung around and was trapped in this gap. So it is between the platform and the moving train. Now, this has happened to people before. When it happens to men who are generally bigger, they get trapped there and twisted and twisted and twisted. Their lower body twists as the train goes, but they are still conscious and alive. And sometimes the train will be stopped by authorities and the family will come and have to say goodbye to their loved one trapped there. And then once the train moves on, their lower half of their body falls out of themselves and they die immediately. If a child falls in the gap, the child is so small that they fall right through, and then what happens is up to fate. I was just the size that as I was being circled around the train in the gap, my hips broke. My pelvis literally cracked because that was the widest part, but it cracked just enough that I then was sucked under the train and fell through the gap, which is a lucky thing because had I been stuck there, all my organs would have been twisted around. So now I am under the train and totally conscious, by the way, and it is so loud. That was the thing that I most remember is how loud being under a train is. And I thought to myself when I was under there, I had three very, very distinct thoughts. I can't believe this is happening. This is happening. And oh my God, I'm going to die. And once I decided I was going to die, I became incredibly calm. And all of a sudden, the 5 pounds that I was desperate to lose my whole life didn't matter. And my grades didn't matter. And all the things that I thought were important didn't matter. And I just sort of eased into this split second of my life will be over. When I got sucked under the train, it was in between two cars. And so I had a couple seconds before a wheel was going to slice me in half. In that couple seconds, something clicked in, and I instinctively flung myself over the rail and landed 6 feet underneath the platform. So now I am lying on gravel and looking up, and up ahead, the train is still moving. And as I'm lying there, two things happened. One, I realized there were hundreds of rats crawling on top of me. And usually this would freak me the fuck out. But I thought, you know what? This is their home. This is where they live. I just fell into their house. I can't worry about the rats. And just was probably in shock and was like, okay, rats, here you go. And the other weird thing was I realized, why am I conscious? Why am I so comfortable? I'm lying here and my head is like it's on a pillow. And I turned my neck and I realized that the faux fur cow print bag that my sister had made for me acted as a pillow every time I fell, and it swung up and protected my head. So I was lying perfectly on this soft, big bag. And from my neck down was sort of a bloody mess. And from my neck up was perfect. I never had a scratch on my face. I never had any brain injury. It was incredible. As I'm lying there, I also realize I can't move my legs. And this horrible feeling of, am I paralyzed, came over me. And then I thought, I'll wiggle my toes inside my giant platform boots. And if I can wiggle my toes, I'm not paralyzed. So I wiggled my toes and I could feel my toes hitting the edges of inside my shoe. And I thought, okay, I'm not paralyzed. Then the train comes to a stop and the noise is lessened. And the man who yelled, don't jump, was on top of the platform screaming down to me, hello, are you alive? And I scream, yes, I'm alive. And he screams, do you have your legs? Because he can't imagine getting out of that with my legs. And I'm lying there and I'm like, I have my legs, but I can't move them. I can't move, but I can't believe I'm alive. And he's screaming down, I can't believe you have your legs. I've called 911. They're on their way. So I'm waiting for people to come help me, and I'm lying there and I'm, you know, thinking about my life and why have I survived this and how did my mother somehow know something weird was going to happen today because she called 10 times and she never calls. And I have to go to Africa and help people less fortunate, and I have to do something good because here I am and I've survived this ordeal. So the EMTs arrive. And I remember two very handsome big men who figured out how to get underneath the platform. And they get under there. They put a blanket on me. They bored my neck and my spine because I couldn't move. They weren't sure if I had a spinal cord injury. And they now have to figure out how to get me back up and out. So the train is moved away. So the train leaves. And now this makes the gap much bigger because now there's no train. So two other EMTs stood on the train tracks, and two EMTs below picked me up on the board and vertically pulled me up through the gap when the two other men pulled me up. And in this moment, I'm thinking, oh my God, I shouldn't have eaten so much Mexican food because I'm fat, and how are they going to lift me up? And then I realized I've only survived this for like probably 45 minutes, and I'm already back to my original personality of caring about the 5 pounds that I wish I could lose. So I'm put into the ambulance. My clothes are being cut off me. I'm being hooked up to every type of machine possible. And as we discussed a little earlier, I'm actually terrible with needles and terrible with hospital things. But there, I was in such shock and so much adrenaline that I didn't even care what was happening to me. I get to the hospital, and I, after many different tests and procedures, I am told that I have broken my pelvis, and the amount of force that it takes to do that to a healthy 20-year-old means I probably have some organ damage, and possibly my bladder is compromised, and I learned that if urine gets into your bloodstream, you die. So they bring a priest in the room because they're telling me I'm going to die. And I start screaming, I'm Jewish. I don't want a priest. So he leaves. And then they say, well, you should call the people you love. So I call my mother first. And she's wide awake waiting for that phone call. She knew all day long something was going to happen to me. And she immediately, you know, books a flight to try and get to Providence. She's in Miami. So I miraculously survived the night. I do have some internal bleeding and I have a broken pelvis, but amazingly, my bladder is fine, my organs are fine. And towards the end of the night, I realize I have no clothes. So I have to now call my best friend whose grandmother had died, who just turned 21, and say, by the way, I got dragged under a train. Can you come bring me some sweatpants? So I call her and she answers and she's so drunk and she's so out of it. And she's like, okay, yeah, sure. And she hangs up and, you know, she doesn't come for hours. And I had later found out that she just went back to sleep. Like, what a weird phone call that was. And popped up like 3 hours later. Holy shit. Oh my God. Sasha got dragged under a train and is at the hospital. So she finally arrives with some sweatpants and some clean clothes, and she curls up on the foot of my hospital bed and just sleeps. The poor thing had the worst 21st birthday in the history of 21st birthdays. The nurses and doctors couldn't believe I survived the night. They all got lottery tickets with my birthday number, with my birthday as the numbers, and I was completely stable. I needed to then rehabilitate my bones, but my organs were good, my heart was good, my lungs were good, and again, no brain damage because of that amazing bag that my sister had made me. So I'm released from the hospital the next day. And also, when I was pulled up from the EMTs on the platform, I realized there were news cameras, and this was a big story for Providence, Rhode Island, and there's nothing much happens there. And but I was, you know, too much in shock to really think about that too much. So I then am, my mother meets me, and my father is still in Miami, sort of freaking out, and I am basically told that I could have pins put in or I could just not move for 3 months. And the not moving is the better bet because then everything will heal the right way, and it's less complications. So I flew back home to Miami, where my father got everything set up for me, and laid in bed for 3 months with my bones healing, and then was in a wheelchair for several months, and then on crutches. And needless to say, I did miss class. I missed a lot of class, but because my grades were so good and I always got my work done on time, all my professors gave me big leeway, and I ended up getting everything done that I needed to and graduated on time. So the craziest part of this entire story is that when the article came out about the accident, what I learned was the train was actually pulling into the station. It wasn't leaving at all. So I jumped on a train coming into the station. And had I waited 2 minutes and stood there, I could have just stepped on the train and gone back to Boston. And the reason the man said don't jump is because he knew the train was coming into the station and that the train was late. I wasn't late. And that revelation, I was so mortified when that came out in the news, and I was so embarrassed, and I didn't tell anyone for years. And then I realized what an incredible analogy for life, that life, like a train, you cannot see if it's coming or going when you're standing in the middle of it because it's too big. And if you just give yourself a minute and you stand back and you think, you might make better decisions. And that is my story of getting dragged under an Amtrak train.
That is so fascinating. And I have to tell you guys out there in the audience that Sasha wasn't reading that. She just knew that story. So it's so perfect. It's crafted so well. Every word is important. And you had me so much that I became a little faint. And we had to take a break from recording because the story is so, it's just so terrifying. And I kept thinking about your mom, of course, you know, and the fact that she kind of felt that in her blood that something was going to happen to you that day.
Yes.
It's stunning.
She knew, and she has this incredible instinct. And a year later, I had a trip planned to Morocco. And again, she is not an overbearing mother. She is very much go be you, do what you want to do my whole life. But once I had this trip planned, she said, you know, I have a really bad feeling about you going to Morocco. I would like you to cancel. And I did.
Wow.
Because I thought she knows something. And I canceled the trip and, you know, traveled actually, you know, many other times, many other places.
Sure.
But I listened to her instinct after.
Do you know if anything happened to happen in Morocco?
I don't know that anything did happen. Nothing, no big national news happened. But,
yeah, but
who
it could
knows
have
been what
a
small thing.
Or an assault. It
could
have been
yeah,
anything.
She yeah. just had a little feeling, and I've learned to listen to her little feelings.
First of all, cowhide was so popular in 97.
Yes.
Because I had pants that just had patches of cowhide. And do you still have that purse?
I have that purse. So it
hanging
did,
on the wall.
So the purse broke during the accident, but of course I have it. I saved it, and I have the purse in my office closet on display. And then friends of mine for my 40th birthday took the strap and turned the strap into a big S for Sasha and had it framed, which is incredible. So that's framed
so
in my house as well.
Yeah, that is so beautiful to have those sorts of artifacts that tell stories like this. It's just so crazy. Okay, how did you get, to just go back for a second, how did you get to be such a good student if you were literally snorting coke at 13? How did that turn around?
Well, I was always a really good student. Grades were important to me, and I was always very organized. Even in my drug use, I was sort of organized and uptight to make sure that I trusted my drug dealer and to make sure. And, you know, I was not ever a stoner. I never liked downers.
Yeah.
I only liked uppers because to me, they made me even more exceptional, and I could get more done.
Well, you have to
and
smoke a sativa, and that's exactly what will happen.
Yeah. And so I was really acting out when I was 13 and 14. But then, you know, I also chose to go to public school in Miami Beach because I wanted to be with sort of, I felt being with different types of people and real types of people instead of going to a private school.
Right.
I thought it'd be more interesting and more, and actually would give me a better education in the sense of, oh, this is the world. And sadly, getting straight A's in public school in Miami, even with AP classes, is not that hard. But I pulled it together and cleaned up my act by the end of ninth grade. So really, I was had plenty of time to be drug-free and be a good student.
I can't get over. Did you have to have help getting through the drug part? I mean, at that young.
I did. I did. I had a friend who got into some really bad things when she was older and she had already dropped out, and I felt I needed to help her. And I went to a counselor at the school to talk about how I could help her. And the counselor took one look at me and said, I think you need help.
Wow.
And that was the first time I had considered, oh, wait, I shouldn't be running around doing coke and I'm 13 years old. So I started going to NA meetings and
NA.
Narcotics Anonymous. Uh-huh. And loved it because it was something sort of new to be addicted to, because
so
there were rules, yeah, and guidelines and steps, and
yeah,
it was very, it spoke to me perfectly, like organized principles. Yes, I
maybe
needed.
Your mom was just too hippy dippy.
She was too. Yes, she absolutely.
How about for your siblings?
They have had their own journeys of.
But were they raised the same way?
Yes.
Did they go to public school?
They went to public school, and we were all sort of raised to have our own, to be into, even, you know, it's an interesting way to raise children, but even, you know, as like a three-year-old, I could wear what I wanted.
Yeah.
I could eat what I wanted. I was to make my own choices.
Yeah.
And
that's beautiful.
And another, you know, amazing thing my parents did was they told me to talk to strangers, because they said, we want you to have a built-in feeling about people. And if you're told as a child never to talk to strangers, how do you know when to trust your instincts? So they would send me off to the park to go talk to that weird guy over there. So I knew how to feel who was trustworthy or not.
Wow. That's groundbreaking. I'm telling you, as a parent, that's very interesting. Because of course I tell my daughter not to talk. Well, I do and I don't. Like sometimes, you know, I'll say, I don't know, ask him. You know, if she says something like about in the store, well, what do you think that is? Or I say, I don't know, ask the guy who works here. I don't work here. So I will, but it's always in that safe way. I can't let her, well, that's a whole other
yeah,
story.
Yeah, no, it's a weird, and also this was very much a different time. This
yeah,
is the
yeah,
late
yeah.
70s, early 80s.
And
when
you were in Miami, and not LA.
Yes, and well, in Miami. Well, Miami was the murder capital of the country at that time. It was.
Yes, and you had Coconut Grove.
Yes, yes.
And all that cocaine, my God.
Yes.
Miami was just, every time I've been there, it does feel saturated with cocaine.
It
even
is.
Even now.
It's bananas. It's bananas. I was just there a few months ago, actually, at this kind of, like late night dinner restaurant dinner
on South
club
Beach?
This was actually South Beach is sort of a little sad now. It's a little touristy, a little like Coney Island, and the new cool spot is Wynwood, where Art Basel is, and that's
okay,
sort of where all
okay.
the people. So I was there, and these people were doing lines of coke at their table. No one minded at all, but this other man was smoking a cigar at his table, and the manager came right over and said, sir, you can't smoke in here. And I thought, how perfect that in Miami the smoke was bothering everybody, because you can smell it, whereas the coke wasn't bothering anybody.
That's the craziest thing,
yeah,
man. That's super crazy. Okay, listen, to go back real quick to the story. In the morning, when the train went past you, and then you're there, and then the guy calls down, you know, hello, are you there? And then you were having that conversation. Did he hit a bell? Did he hit an alarm? What did he do?
Well, so I thought at that time he had hit an alarm to stop the train because, oh my God, a girl has just gotten eaten by this train. But looking back, I realized the train had stopped because it was pulling into the station and it was stopping anyway.
Right, right, right.
So had... I'm sure had the train been on its way out, he would have somehow, contacted the driver of that train to
but
stop
the train
it.
Was already
but the train
stopped.
Was already
it was
stopped.
The way it needed to be.
Yes.
And then also in that regard, they didn't have to like call off transit or
no.
whatever because
then
nothing
it,
else was coming.
Right. And then it rumbled on as planned, and then they could get me out because there was more room
and since
underneath.
It was 12:15 in the morning, there was nobody around.
Nobody, not a soul, only
was there
that one
on
man.
The train?
I don't know, actually. I don't know if there was or not, or if they were.
So then I was thinking to myself, like, when you're in the ambulance, did they say to you, what were you doing?
Well, everyone assumed I was drunk or on drugs. Oh. Because I was a college student and I jumped on a train and they did a tox screen the first thing at the hospital because, you know, totally clean, totally sober. And
wait,
so,
what does that mean? Like blood and urine?
Yeah, they did blood to see was I on drugs? Was I drunk? And actually Amtrak thought that I would sue them because technically that door should not have been able to be opening and closing as the train
is
moving.
That is so true. I'm mad at them.
But
that is so true. That's a good place to direct your anger.
Well, however, I was an intelligent person and should not have jumped on a train. And so I did not want to sue them. Because
but it wouldn't have been tempted. You would not have been tempted.
I wouldn't have been tempted. I wouldn't have been tempted. But so what we agreed on is they ended up covering all medical expenses.
Oh, that's good.
They were happy to do that because I wasn't.
You should also get a train car named after you. That'd be so cool. The Sasha.
The Sasha, right.
Yes. Fly by. The Rothschild. Hey, right. You want to catch the Rothschild?
The Rothschild would be the dining car.
Yeah, like you'd be down on the surf liner going down to San Diego. Right. And then they'd say, like, would you like to go to the Rothschild for dinner?
Yes.
Are you ready?
It's not about Amtrak if you're listening.
Listen, I am so happy you're alive. I'm blown away. This is a crazy story. By the way, I bet you in the ambulance, they took those stupid shoes off you so fast, right?
They took the shoes off, and the shoes I never got back. The shoes were cut. Actually, the shoes were cut off. The jeans. One thing I do remember is when they were cutting my jeans off, I was like, these are my favorite jeans.
Wow.
And they were sort of, I was so.
You were so conscious.
Conscious. And so I was elated to be alive. And everyone was telling me I might die, but I couldn't quite believe it because I was surged with so much adrenaline.
Did you think you were going to see like bloody stumps on your legs or no? Because you felt your feet.
I could feel my toes and I just knew something was terribly wrong because I couldn't move my legs, but I knew that I had feeling. And so that calmed me in that way. And I just couldn't believe that I would die. I just felt too alive to die. And
this is it's an amazing, amazing story. I would love to see this worked into something that you'd write for television. You know, this could be the start of something.
Yeah.
And then maybe after the train accident, she gets a magic power. We don't know.
Right.
This could just be the premise.
The rat power of having all the rats crawl over me.
Hey, man, thank you so much for sharing this. Really, this
You're
was
welcome.
Just fantastic. Thank you. All right, you guys, we got to wrap it up. And I want to thank everybody out there for tuning in today and listening to Storyworthy. And a big shout out to all the sponsors on the show. When you guys support my sponsors, you're supporting me. And I thank you so, so much. And don't forget to give Sasha a shout out on Twitter and tweet her over there at Sasha Rothschild. And of course, follow me over there as well at Storyworthy.
And join us next week on Storyworthy for a story about hiking Mount Kilimanjaro by actress Roxana Ortega.
The next day, we had to not walk, but scale a wall with all four of our limbs to get up this thing called the Barranco Wall. It's whatever. I did it, okay?
Don't miss Roxana Ortega next week on Storyworthy.
And on behalf of everybody over at Wondery Media, including Hernan Lopez and everybody on the Wondery team, and on behalf of you, Sasha Rothschild, thank you so much, really.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a career.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com. I'll keep you safe.